from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum in our opening hour this morning, the San Francisco Bay Area is expected to grow with 2.1 million people by 2040. Plan Bay Area, a regional transportation and housing plan to accommodate this growth while reducing greenhouse gas emissions, was approved on Friday by the Association of Bay Area Governments and the Metropolitan Transportation Commission. We'll discuss the plan, and we'll hear from critics who fear the plan will lessen their local autonomy and erode the small-town character of their neighborhoods. Forum is next. Join us after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. Plan Bay Area is a transportation and housing plan designed to accommodate population growth of all income levels and reduce greenhouse gas emissions 30% by 2020 and 80% by 2050. It was passed amidst a great deal of contentiousness on Friday, nearly unanimously, by elected officials. Officials representing the nine Bay Area counties, and the plan fulfills the guidelines set forth in Senate Bill 375, which requires a cutting down of pollution in the state's 18 metropolitan areas. It also maps out long-range housing, jobs, and transportation, a 40-year regional land use plan that directs growth of housing and jobs along what it terms priority development areas, areas near mass transit and or existing traffic corridors where jobs and services have been identified for growth by local governments. The plan was approved by the Association of Bay Area Governments and the Metropolitan Transportation Commission, and we discuss it in this opening forum hour. Joining us in studio is Angela Hard, who has been covering the story for the San Francisco Public Press. She's a writer there. Good morning.
Morning, Michael.
Glad to have you with us. Also glad to have Ken Kirky, who's a planning director with the Metropolitan Transportation Commission, formerly planning director with ABAG, Association of Bay Area Governments. Welcome, Ken Kirky.
Good morning, Michael.
Good morning to you, and we'll also say good morning to Stephanie Reyes, who is senior program director with Greenbelt Alliance. And welcome, Stephanie Reyes.
Thank you.
Glad to have you all aboard. And if I may, Angela Hard, I'd like to just begin with you, perhaps get an overview of what we're talking about here. This was, for the most part, set up really to sustain communities and to protect climate protection, from part of the Climate Protection Act going back to 2008. It's really all about smart growth, though. I mean, it's because of the population growth.
Yeah, yeah, well, the and Steinberg, who authored the law himself, has said the impetus for this was climate change as the overarching goal. And he also has said that the Bay Area is going to grow. So seeing that it's going to grow, we need to, instead of just letting it grow without any boundaries, let's set forth a set of policies where that directs investment and future development in city centers. And for Plan Bay Area, most of that is in San Francisco, Oakland, and San Jose.
So much of this has to do with population density and dealing with what's coming, the tsunami that's coming, but also really air pollution and higher traffic congestion. It's a plan to really, in a kind of holistic way, deal with those problems, yeah?
The crux of it is to get people to drive less, yes.
And to use mass transit more. These priority development areas, though, can you explain that to us, how that works?
Yeah, so, and Ken can probably speak to this too, but these priority development areas, think of them as focused city centers that have all your amenities. You have high-density housing. You can go to the library. You can, you know, stop at the store on your way home. There are these locally chosen concentrated growth areas.
And Ken, the environmental impact report pretty much paved the way here?
Well, Michael, the environmental impact report, as you know, it's an environmental impact report on a long-range regional plan. So I think that one of the things that was not necessarily well understood through the process is that every single land use project going through, you know, that's going to be developed in future years here in the Bay Area still goes through the processes that it would have gone through before the plan. If CEQA applies, CEQA would still apply, and local land use authority remains. One thing I would pick up on, I think Angela did a really good job describing the priority development areas. One piece I would mention, though, is that they do range significantly. They are all locally nominated, but they they sort of run the gamut from places such as the area around the future smart station up in Cloverdale, which is, of course, a very different kind of density and scale than the Transbay Terminal here in downtown San Francisco. Mm-hmm. And there really is a range of places that reflect what local communities are seeking in these places they've nominated.
The cost of this, I mean, we're talking about billions of dollars, really, aren't we?
Well, what this plan is, you know, MTC has done a regional transportation plan every 4 years for decades as the regional transportation planning and financing agency. This is still a regional transportation plan, but it now includes a land use component given SB 375. This is a big region. It's a complex region. Mm-hmm. And it runs out to 2040. So, yes, it's a $292 billion plan.
And the main opposition was over, I mean, as far as issues, was over local control, open space, yeah?
Local control was a big issue, and it came primarily from smaller communities. I think one of the things that's been interesting, at least from my perspective, is that, you know, if you look at, say, the dozen or so cities in the region that have more than 100,000 people that live within those cities, more than half of the region's population lives within those cities. Those cities are generally in support of the plan. They're focused on, what do we do to replace redevelopment? What can be done to ensure that CEQA remains a strong law, but that it isn't used as a tool to stop environmentally beneficial infill projects? How can we get these transportation projects that are in the plan moving forward faster? Because transit ridership on our core systems, BART, Muni, Caltrain, et cetera, are rising rapidly as we are seeing a big shift of employers and residents of many employers moving into San Francisco, Oakland, and many of the communities up and down the peninsula in San Jose that are well served by transit and that provide the amenities and the proximity to jobs that people are looking for.
Well, we heard, I think, some opposition from places in the East Bay like Lafayette and Danville, but also in the North Bay. And we'll hear from some in the course of this hour from someone who feels very strongly about that in Marin and Sonoma and Napa. But one of the arguments you also hear is that cars and light trucks are soon going to be greener than transit.
Well, I mean, SB 375 is part of a larger effort here in California to address greenhouse gas emissions. The state really is a leader in terms of trying to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. This is one piece of the puzzle. As Angela was saying, this is related to the fact that historically in California, people have driven a lot, less so in the Bay Area than other big regions in the state, but still substantially, and that if we can have a somewhat different land use pattern going forward than we've had in recent decades, we can potentially reduce the amount of driving that there is. But technology, technological changes to the fleet, all of that is going to be very, very important to reduce greenhouse gas emissions.
But Angela, following up on that, no climate change adaptation and sea level rise still part of the problem, yeah?
Yeah, and one of the things that our reporting project found is that seeing climate change as the background, as the backdrop for this, emissions aren't actually going to fall as a whole. Though, and Ken will say this, and proponents will say this too, they will be less than what they normally would have been without this plan. And this is really just, you know, important also because as the Bay Area grows, you know, there's going to be more and more people that are going to have to make these decisions.
Let me go, if I may, to our Greenbelt Alliance guest here in studio, Angela Reyes. There is a sense of Stephanie, there's a sense of protecting the open spaces here and giving residents options on where they live and how they get around, but concern about economic displacement. Let's just talk about low-income housing, for example, and rent rising as a result.
Sure. Well, you know, it's interesting when we think about affordable housing, everyone in this region has had some experience with our affordable housing crisis. It's our challenge with affordable homes. It's bad for quality of life. Folks end up driving further and further out looking for an affordable place to live. That's a huge impact also on the environment. What's gotten surprisingly little attention in the arena of affordable homes is actually the economic impacts of our affordable housing crisis. So it's interesting. If you look at the Silicon Valley Leadership Group, they are a trade organization of leading businesses in the Bay Area. They conduct a CEO survey on top issues for local businesses, and their 2013 CEO survey once again identified the lack of affordable homes as a top challenge to attracting and retaining employees. So 65% of CEOs cited this as a major issue. So it's clear that the Bay Area's housing crunch is hurting our ability to attract and retain jobs, and local cities really need to do their part to support the construction of new homes at all levels of affordability for the region.
But I was reading Wendell Cox in the Mercury News, and he was saying, why not build rural rather than in the cities?
Well, I think it would be interesting to ask Bay Area voters what they think about that plan. What's exciting to us about Plan Bay Area is that it makes the bold statement that the region is done with sprawl and that we can accommodate all of our future growth within our existing urban boundaries. If we did not implement Plan Bay Area and growth continued as usual, almost half of our future growth would happen by paving over our natural landscapes that we all love and the farms and ranches that provide us with fresh local food.
So the plan protects open space.
That's definitely the reason, one of the reasons we like the plan. And I think looking at what voters are looking for, that's something that they care about very much as well.
And the plan also invests in the current transit system.
That's right.
To a great degree, yeah.
Yes, operating our existing transit system is a key priority.
All right. I want to bring some other voices into this. We're talking with Stephanie Reyes, who is Senior Program Director for the Greenbelt Alliance, and with Ken Kirky, who is Planning Director of the Metropolitan Transit Commission, formerly Planning Director with ABAG, the Association of Bay Area Governments, and Angela Hart, who is a writer for San Francisco Public Press. If you'd like to join us, if you have some questions about this plan or if you have some thoughts about it, and if you simply want to respond to essentially a plan that is supposed to conform to the growth of about 2.1 million people by 2040 and also reduce greenhouse gases, we'd like to hear from you. You can join us now, in fact, at our toll-free number, and we welcome your phone calls. Toll-free, it's 866-733-6786. Again, feel free to join the program and join the conversation toll-free at 866-733-6786. Or you can email us, forum@kqed.org is our email address. Or you can go to our Facebook page or tweet us, our Twitter handle, at KQED Forum. I go back, if I may, Ken Kirky, to you, Planning Director, again, with Metropolitan Transportation Commission. You want to see the existing lanes used as, well, essentially as toll lanes, as opposed to, say, a proposal for high-occupancy tolling and express lanes?
Well, there's a regional express lane component to the plan that looks at doing a couple of things. One, expanding the express lane network that we have. So there are more sections of our freeway system that are available for carpools, are available for express buses. Right now we have some important segments in the North Bay along Highway 80 and some other key freeways in the region where the express lane network is not complete, and therefore express buses don't really achieve their capacity or their potential for really providing a good link for riders to get to work in the morning. And the express lane network would address that. It would also provide for, based upon congestion, an opportunity for a user, if the lane is not being fully utilized, to pay a toll and to utilize the lane. That would help fund the system and build it to the benefit.
So some of your revenue is going to come from, yeah.
That's where the revenue has to come from.
But Angela Hart, this is also, we should mention, a public-private partnership, yeah?
Correct. And one thing I think that, and Ken, maybe you and Stephanie can jump in here too, one thing I think also that's important to point out is that this is really heavily reliant on incentives, if not solely reliant on incentives. And while there is billions of dollars, I think close to $300 billion outlined, that money is anticipated. It's not actually – there's the money that's there, and correct me if I'm wrong, Ken, is actually about $800 million over the next 4 years. Is that right?
Well, it's a long-range plan. There's a substantial amount of funding that is identified in the plan now. For example, relative to transit operations, we know we have enough funding going forward based upon estimates of toll fare recovery, and other sources that those funds will be there. We also, with a long-range plan, we have to look forward and say there will be other sources of money moving forward, coming to the region in the future. One thing that we've seen very dramatically in recent years is a decline in federal and state funding for all forms of transportation. That's led the region to be more self-reliant, and one of the things that we'll be working on to help make it more possible to secure funding for the plan, and particularly for the transportation components, is to hopefully lower the voter threshold to approve a sales tax measure. Folks in Alameda County will recall that last fall, although nearly two-thirds of the voters approved a sales tax measure to support transportation investments in Alameda County, it fell just short, even though well more than 50% of the voters supported that effort. And we hope at MTC that that could be one thing that would change so that regionally we can address through a self-help mechanism some of the needs of the region here.
And Stephanie Reyes, why has Greenbelt gotten behind this? I mean, what's the most positive element of this issue from your perspective?
Well, I think what's great about Plan Bay Area is that it's good for both people and the planet. So we talked a little bit earlier about the benefits of making sure that this plan protects our open spaces that we all love. In addition to that, Plan Bay Area will provide people with more options for how to get around because it plans for new homes and offices to be located in walkable neighborhoods near transit. And that's not only good for the climate and reducing air pollution, it also improves quality of life. So when people have the option to live closer to work or take the train, it means shorter commutes and more time with family. And then shorter commutes and more transit riders means less traffic on our freeways and expressways. And one last thing I wanted to mention also are the health benefits of Plan Bay Area. There were several physicians who actually showed up on Thursday night at this final approval hearing to say it is essential for the future health of our population that we move forward with this plan, not only for the air pollution reductions, but also because Plan Bay Area will increase daily walking and biking by 17%, which will have a huge positive health impact due to additional physical activity.
Again, Stephanie Reyes is Senior Program Director with Greenbelt Alliance. We want to hear from some voices in opposition here, and then we'll hear from you, our listeners. Tom Rubin is a mass transit consultant, and Tom Rubin is joining us this morning from Los Angeles. Good morning. Do we have Tom Rubin on the line here?
I'm here.
Oh, okay.
Good morning.
Good morning. Didn't know if you were there for a moment, but Tom, your opposition has a lot to do with, I guess, well, better ways to reduce greenhouse gas emissions than the land use strategy. And from your perspective, is this wasteful to do it that way?
Yes. This is just a very, very poorly constructed plan. In so many ways, I do not have the time to begin to explain why. But let's start with one, that the requirement that is being met is to meet the target of achieving 1990 level of emissions by 2020. And the bill, SB 325, that they're trying to implement actually says without improved land use and transportation policy, California will not be able to achieve the goals of AB 32. Well, if you look at the data, and this is from the state and national agencies in charge of this, most likely we met that target last year without any of these land use things going into effect. More important, if you go to the plan, land use and transport and transit have almost no impact on greenhouse gas emissions. Best case, using some very, very strange assumptions from MTC and ABAG, land use will be 6.25% of the total emissions between now and 2040.
So the numbers, excuse me, Tom, the numbers from ABAG and MTC don't gel in your judgment?
Not at all, and those are incredibly optimistic. They make several mistakes and violate the actual policies of the state that they're supposed to implement.
And are we talking about a plan that has teeth to it or that can get the funding that's necessary?
Well, that's one of the biggest problems, as even MTC's own executive director stated last week, the funding isn't there. And the land use that they're talking about, the stack and pack, will require huge taxpayer subsidies. And the money just doesn't exist. But the plan is put together on the assumption that it will be done and that people will want to move in, which we also find incredibly unrealistic.
Let me get a response from you, Ken Kirky, on really two salient points here. The money's not there and the fact that the greenhouse gas emission numbers are not, are, shall we say, a bit too cheerful.
Well, yeah, first on that first point, Michael, you know, if you walk out the doors of your studios here in San Francisco and take a quick look around, you'll see, I don't know, two dozen or so cranes in the sky. There is a major movement of people into these neighborhoods in the region now. What we found through the last recession, and it occurred to me this morning, the last time I was on this program was after SB 375 had been passed, and we were right in the middle of the recession. We now see the Bay Area emerging from the recession. Over the last couple of years, one of the strongest economies in the region, driven in large part by companies and workers that want to be in the kinds of locations that Stephanie spoke about earlier. This is even given the loss of redevelopment. We're seeing this scale of development in this movement. And we know that through the recession, the areas that held their value most significantly are areas that were close to employment, well served by transit in the core of the region. Does that mean that that type of housing is for everyone? Absolutely not. There will still be people who want to live in more suburban locations and single-family homes, and the plan doesn't push back at that at all. In terms of the financing, you know, the plan takes a lot of first steps. We have major transit projects underway in the region right now. BART to San Jose is underway. The first phase of SMART is underway. We have some major connections and improvements along the freeway system that will address some of the congestion issues. But it is a long-range plan. This region's been very successful at bringing funding for transportation projects over the years, and we expect we will continue to be in the future. And lastly, in terms of the financing that's needed to build the housing in the plan, that is an issue. Although the market is strong, as I mentioned, one of the key advocacy points in the plan is that we believe, MTC and ABAG, working with local jurisdictions, and we've heard this from many cities in the region, that something needs to be done to replace redevelopment. And that's particularly true for communities that are not the strongest markets in the region, that they do need infrastructure dollars to make this happen.
Tom Rubin, can I get a response from you?
Certainly. First of all, transit has been going way down for years. The ridership in 2011 was 9% down in terms of total trips and over 40% down in terms of trips per capita since 1980. MTC and the rest of the transit agencies have been throwing more and more money, twice as much money that's inflation adjusted, as in 1980, and the ridership has been going significantly down all over. And yet, what the plan projects is that the ridership will double and spending less money to do it. And they do this by the fantastic assumption that the utilization will somehow increase after it has been decreasing for decades. By utilization, I mean the average number of people on a bus or a train. Does anybody really believe that there will be 42% more people in each BART car going through the tube in the morning? That's what's in the plan.
Again, Tom Rubin is a mass transit consultant. He's with us from Los Angeles, but is based in Oakland. And when we come back from a brief break, we're going to continue this discussion and bring you into it. And again, there are a number of ways you can join us, and we do welcome your involvement, either by phone toll-free at 866-733-6786 or by email, forum@kqed.org, or go to our website, which is kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment. Again, Ken Kirkey here with us, planning director for the MTC, Angela Hart, a writer for San Francisco Public Press, and Stephanie Reyes, senior program director for the Greenbelt Alliance. You're listening to Forum. Again, appreciate your being with us, Tom Rubin. We'll say goodbye to you, and we'll say hello to our listeners when we return. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Plan Bay Area has been approved. The San Francisco Bay Area is expected to grow by 2.1 million people by the year 2040. And Plan Bay Area, which is a regional transportation and housing plan to accommodate this growth while reducing greenhouse gas emissions, was approved on Friday by the Association of Bay Area Governments and the Metropolitan Transportation Commission. We're discussing the plan. We're going to hear from some critics, hear from you as well. People fear the plan will lessen their local autonomy and erode their small town character, their neighborhoods. And with us for the hour is Stephanie Reyes, who is Senior Program Director for Greenbelt Alliance, Angela Hart, writer for San Francisco Public Press, and Ken Kirky, Planning Director for the Metropolitan Transportation Commission and formerly Planning Director with the Association of Bay Area Governments. And Angela Hart was saying off the air that there is some this whole incentive way of incentivizing and getting revenue out of this is really tied to ideology.
Yeah, well, the plan, and critics often say that the plan is squishy in that, not only in terms of funding, because the funding, there's really just a drop in the bucket in terms of funding that's actually set aside at present. But also what often gets overlooked is that the plan really sets requirements to zone for this new development, new housing, but there's no teeth, there's no legal or any other kind of...
There's no case law for it, really, is there?
Right, for enforcing these actual projects to get built. So what many have said, even people who have worked on the project have said, this is really just an idea rather than a concrete policy.
Stephanie Reyes, you see it more than an idea?
Well, I think that it's a really interesting question about, given that the statute is pretty clear that local governments will still have full control over their planning and zoning, how is this plan going to be carried forward? And I think the beauty of Plan Bay Area is that it shows what's possible. What can we achieve if local cities and towns choose to grow in a way that's consistent with this vision? And, of course, the answer is we can preserve our beautiful open spaces and agricultural land, prevent premature deaths from air pollution, help address the obesity crisis, and reduce per capita greenhouse gas emissions. And if local cities and towns understand what's possible, they're much more likely to choose to grow in a planet-friendly and people-friendly way. I also think the small pots of financial incentives for places that are doing their part for sustainable growth and development are an important piece of the puzzle as well, not to mention the economic imperative that we talked about earlier.
Well, I'm looking at some emails and tweets, and some of them follow a similar motif here. Let me just give you a sampling. Vinit writes, how will we preserve the small-town feel of our various bay and ocean cities? Will this area end up like another Los Angeles or Spreadlana? As a new resident of Pacifica, a city I chose to get away from my past life experiences in New Delhi, Atlanta, and Los Angeles, I pray Bay Area does not become one of those virus metropolis that just keeps growing and growing and that loses its small-town character. Do note that by small-town character, I'm not referring to just a quaint, picturesque aspect, but the civic responsibility that it brings. Can any plan even address that? And Brian tweets, of course the small-town vibe will go away. We can't think of the Bay Area as a set of cities, but instead as a metroplex. Ken Kirk?
Michael, I think one of the strengths of the plan is that it really is a bottoms-up plan. It takes the aspirations, particularly through the priority development areas, which is a wonky term. But when you break it down and you look at places in various communities, whether it's downtown Walnut Creek or downtown Petaluma or downtown San Jose, these are all very different places. One of the things that MTC and ABAC have done in recent years is to fund planning grants in those communities, to fund neighborhood plans so that communities could get away from a project-by-project approach to development. And neighborhood aspirations and community aspirations could be fulfilled. In many ways, this plan is a compilation of those community aspirations region-wide. It doesn't at all move this region in the direction of being more homogenous. I think, if anything, it goes in the opposite direction of really trying to recognize the strengths of individual communities, along with what Stephanie spoke about. It says that we can hold the urban limit lines, the urban growth boundaries, the agricultural zoning that voters in 8 of the 9 counties, meaning the counties outside of the city and county of San Francisco, have approved over the years, so that Napa Valley can stay Napa Valley, that the agricultural lands of Western Marin can remain in ag. If one likes open space, if one believes in local control, there is every reason to believe in this plan.
Let me bring some of our callers on. We begin with Rosemary from Richmond. Good morning.
Good morning.
Yes, ma'am. You're on the air.
I have to admit, I used to be the mayor of Richmond, and I have to admit that I haven't read this plan, but I've been involved in a lot of these discussions over the years, and I support the concept very strongly. And one problem that we had when we were pushing affordable housing was that people don't understand the definition of it. And it's based on county averages. And in Richmond, affordable housing is often market rate housing. And often the people who complain about it live in affordable housing. But the problem,
nevertheless, they start talking about NIMBYism right away, almost reflexively.
Well, they're worried about, and I would like to find housing for all of the homeless, but that's what they're picturing is, you know, crime and things that are way beyond. But what they have to understand is it's housing for the teachers and the public safety workers and the public works workers in their community, and it's better to have them living next door to them. And that's true of all the counties. It happens. Richmond's kind of skewed because it's in Contra Costa County and the average is high. But in all counties, it's county by county based, and it's based on averages in the county. And one of the things that irked me was that often when communities would finally accept affordable housing, they only wanted to do senior citizen housing. And as nice as that is, and I'm a senior citizen, Richmond can't take all of the family affordable housing in the Bay Area, or Richmond and Pittsburgh and a few other cities. It needs to be spread around. And the last thing I'd like to comment on is when money is being given to communities for affordable housing, it ought to be based on housing that is below market rate, so that the developers who come into Richmond to develop, if they're going to build low or moderate income housing, they shouldn't be getting subsidies. That should be going to other communities that need it for housing that's below market rate. And Richmond needs funding for low income housing.
Yeah, thank you for the call, Rosemary. It's good to hear from you. And I'm prompted to ask Angela Hart, how much of the plan involves the expectation or hope of grant money?
All of it right now at this point. There's a program called the One Bay Area Grant Program, and essentially it's a pool of money that cities can fight over, if you will, for developing housing and making, for example, transit lines more robust in these city centers, what's called these priority development areas. But all of it is grant money at this point. Right.
Let me bring another caller in here. I want to go to Mountain View. Eileen, thanks for waiting. Join us. You're on.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I'm sorry to hear this is just a nice idea, this plan. But having gone to several meetings over the years to find emergency funding for Caltrain, I wondered if you can please tell me what the provision is for long-term, permanent, reliable funding for Caltrain, and I'll take my answer off the air.
Okay. Thank you for the question. We'll go to Ken Kirky.
Well, I think, you know, Caltrain is an interesting system in that because it serves three counties, it to some degree isn't necessarily always the first priority of any given jurisdiction, yet it's one of the most heavily utilized and successful commuter rail lines in the entire country. And I think in stark contrast to what Mr. Rubin was suggesting earlier, its ridership has been rising dramatically in recent years, and it has pretty decent rolling stock, but nonetheless, one of the things the plan does, and I just want to clarify that there's substantial money in this plan for transportation investments. There's nearly $700 million that's going forward for Caltrain electrification. That will provide for a faster, cleaner fleet. It will also provide for the basis for high-speed rail to go forward as a blended system up and down the peninsula. So there are many benefits to that funding, and that funding is real. As far as the governance of Caltrain, I don't know the details at this moment, but I think that's something you'll be hearing more about. Clearly, Caltrain is really, really important for the region moving forward. And also just on the last piece in terms of what is available in terms of grants, and Angela mentioned the One Bay Area Grant Program, does the plan solve all of the problems of a region of 7+ million people? No, it does not. But I think it does provide a very solid roadmap for us moving forward. The One Bay Area Grant Program, for example, is innovative in the state of California. None of the comparable plans in Sacramento, Los Angeles, San Diego have anything like this. It really looks at where growth is going to occur moving forward and directs resources to those places. It's a fundamental change in terms of how transportation dollars have been used in the past, and it's meant to really leverage funds so that in a given neighborhood, when a city is looking at a neighborhood that needs investments for street improvements, park amenities, streetscape improvements, better connectivity at the transit station, they can leverage those dollars and then incentivize affordable housing development in those neighborhoods. And we do have, for example, a program called the Transit-Oriented Affordable Housing Program. Again, a very innovative program, actually won an award from EPA, that uses transportation dollars to fund transit-oriented affordable housing in priority development areas. It's a $100 million revolving loan fund. Does it solve the entire problem of affordable housing in the Bay Area? No, but it's a significant step moving forward. And lastly, I'll just mention that our commission and the board of ABAG on Thursday night, among other things, looking at cap and trade funds with the hope that cap and trade funds might, after this year, return to the regions. They'll be used by the governor for the budget this year, but in the future, if they're available, that affordable housing as well as transit capital and operations would be eligible uses for those funds, and that's about $3.1 billion over the life of the plan.
Let me go to some emails here that take a much more dim view, if I may. Here's a listener from Southern Marin named Luke who says, Plan Bay Area is part of a strategy by advocates of urbanizing Marin. It won't help low-income residents, greenhouse gas emissions, traffic, mass transit, equity, equality, or jobs. The proponents have been spreading false information. It has been shown conclusively that PBA fails in every criteria required by Senate Bill 375, especially greenhouse gas emissions. Plan Bay Area benefits only developers of high-density housing. They tried this in Marinello when they tried to build 200,000 units, and the residents of Marin fought it for 20 years to preserve what is now the Marin Headlands. And I suppose this might be a good time to bring Bob Silvestri into the discussion, who is an architect, author of The Best Laid Plans, Our Planning and Affordable Housing Challenges in Marin. He's a resident of Mill Valley. And Bob Silvestri, good to have you aboard. Welcome.
Thanks for having me, Michael.
I guess I appreciate your being here. And I guess the place to begin with you is your skepticism. I mean, from your perspective, this plan not only doesn't necessarily achieve what it purports to or expects to or hopes to, but from your perspective, it's particularly bad for the North Bay. Why? For Marin and Sonoma and Napa?
Well, let me say first off, Michael, I would just want to add that I'm a former affordable housing developer, owner and developer. I worked on approximately 2,000 units of Section 8. And I'm also a founder and have run an environmental nonprofit for 10 years, so I'm not unknowledgeable or insensitive to all the range of issues here. I think the plan is probably a reasonable approach for San Francisco, San Jose, Oakland, urban areas. I just don't think it addresses the challenges that Marin, Napa, and Sonoma have. I mean, we already have walkable, people-friendly towns. I barely use my car. My town couldn't be more walkable. And we don't have sprawl in Marin. I mean, it's not possible because 65% of our land is dedicated open space. Another 20% is either wetlands or agricultural dedicated. So this is a plan suited for an urban larger-scale development solution, which is fine where that's required or where people want that, but 90% of the opportunities that we have in Marin to actually address our housing needs, which are suburban and rural, are for small infill mixed-use projects, and those are not really helped by this plan in any way.
Stephanie Race, what would you say to Bob Silvestri?
Well, I'm thrilled to hear that Bob is supportive of seeing more affordable homes in communities in Marin. They're very much needed. In fact, if you think about the climate change perspective, Marin has a huge in-commute of low-income workers who can't afford to live in the county, have to drive in from farther and farther away. That's probably Marin County's biggest climate impact. So it's
very
important.
He's also saying the plan doesn't really work for Marin or for the North Bay, though.
You know, it's interesting. There are some very high-quality affordable housing developments in the cities of San Rafael, Novato, other places in Marin County that I think it would be well worth looking at as good examples of what can be achieved in the counties of Marin. Also, the idea of small infill mixed-use developments are exactly what Plan Bay Area is all about. So I think that's a perfect fit.
And again, there's a lot of contentiousness on that. I read where Supervisor Susan Adams, for example, has been in Marin County, has been getting a lot of hell for even proposing ideas of bringing in more affordable housing. Bob Silvestri, thank you for joining us. Good to hear your voice here. I want to bring some more callers in, and we'll go to Oakland next. Chris, you're on.
Yeah, MTC is being totally hypocritical about this. Don't look at what they say. Look at what they do and look at how they're going to spend their money. Their biggest chunk of money, $8 billion, is going for sprawl-inducing freeway expansion out into the exurbs, out into Solano and Sonoma counties and all over the place. Their transit investments are largely investments in sprawl-inducing rail. They are attacking the local transit agencies, primarily attacking the local transit agencies and unions, and telling them to cut back on how much they spend, but don't cut any of your service, which, of course, is impossible. So don't look at what they say. I like what they say. Look at what they do.
Okay, we'll let that comment stand unless it looks as if Ken, you want to respond.
Yeah. Yeah, I would like to follow up on that. I mean, first of all, the reference to $8 billion, that's a regional express lanes network that we spoke about earlier. And a lot of that is providing more capacity for express buses and for carpools in the region. We've got some serious gaps in that system at this point in time, and that would be positive for the climate and positive for the environment. In terms of the general focus of this plan, we are arguably the furthest to the left of any metropolitan planning organization in the country. We have no freeway extensions in this plan. And in terms of our big projects, yes, we have some rail extensions. One of them, which will be completed in the next several years, goes to the largest city in the region, downtown San Jose. And I don't think that, you know, people who live in San Jose see that as a fool's errand. Downtown San Jose is planning for a substantial amount of employment with BART to San Jose. Folks from the East Bay, from throughout the region, will have much better access to those jobs, and it will really provide a center for San Jose that they've been building steadily over the years. It will really accelerate that growth, which is something people in San Jose want to see happen. Lastly, I'll mention that we ran the transportation projects through a very aggressive project performance assessment for this plan. It looked both at cost-benefit as well as the 10 performance goals that were adopted by MTC and ABAG for this plan. The number one project is something called BART Metro. It will provide for more service in the core of the system. It's not an extension. It's a recognition that there's a substantial amount of job and housing growth that's going to be occurring in San Francisco, Oakland, and other communities in the core of the region as we move forward. And as anybody who's been at, say, Montgomery Street Station at any time during the peak hours recently can tell you, those stations need to be larger. We need to have more capacity to move people in and out. So that project would address those sorts of issues.
Actually, I'm looking at some Facebook page remarks here. Johan says, does Plan Bay Area include a BART line between Walnut Creek and Dublin? It's badly needed. And Eric writes, if Plan Bay Area doesn't close the BART loop between Millbrae and San Jose, the plan is by definition a waste of time and money. Caltrain is a pathetic substitute, and making people transfer between the two is not a solution. BART needs to finally fulfill its decade-old promise. Let me read some more comments here. Eric writes, the Bay Area will not be a small-town environment if those growth predictions are right. And Josh tweets, Plan Bay Area opponents bring out stack and pack as the first answer. Newsflash, suburbia is dead. Young people want to live urban. Another listener, Paul from Santa Clara, writes, one of the big things in truly getting high density is a fast, reliable, high-density rail system. With the exception of BART Rail, our rail is slow, heavy, and often unreliable. Does the plan finally deliver around the Bay BART electric Caltrain or replacing Caltrain with BART or Central Expressway, light rail? You know, a lot of these kind of transportation questions, and we'll come to them in a moment here. But Christopher writes, how does Plan Bay Area address local zoning laws? Nearly all of the designated transit-oriented development districts still require developers to provide 1.5 parking spots per household, even though the data shows that many who live in these areas do not drive or own a car. Many of these areas also have outdated zoning requirements that do not promote housing density or mixed-use spaces. And Susan says, Plan Bay Area was originally called One Bay Area and seems to be a push towards regional governance. So while there's a need for regional planning, the responsibility and authority to identify housing needs and responses should come from the local level, not be driven by a heavy-handed regional agency that penalizes local communities who don't comply by threatening to withhold transportation dollars. And Ken from Livermore says, I'm a big supporter of mass transit, but from an unofficial field survey in Alameda and Contra Costa counties, me and a few coworkers noticed the number of almost empty buses running through East Bay cities. The existing revenues from riders must be next to nothing. How will they be filled? Some big and important questions here, and maybe questions that could take us a whole hour just by themselves. But Angela Hart, let me first go to you, if I may, on these, particularly in terms of the concerns about BART and mass transit.
This is some of the comments from readers hit on some pretty crucial points, and I just want to outline. There's been a lot of studies recently that you know, this generation is wanting to drive less. They do want to live in inner cities. And Ken will speak to this too. There's an aging senior population who benefit from living closer to transportation lines, for example. There's also, if you'll recall, there's also some research that shows that the Bay Area is number one for mega commuting. That's, I think it's 90 minutes for a one-way commute in the morning. So, I mean, that's kind of the backdrop to a lot of these issues that I think the plan does seek to address. I think one other thing that's important to point out is this is a big, complex policy. It's a big SB 375 is a big law, and AB 32, which is they're very closely tied together, is another big law, big policy. So I think some of the comments that the listeners addressed are important and hit on some very key points.
There's another key point from Barbara, who says, why wasn't the organization that Tom Rubin works for identified? All in-studio guests were identified by their organization. Tom Rubin is identified only as a transportation consultant without mentioning that he is the transportation consultant for the Reason Foundation, a libertarian group with funding from the Koch brothers and links to American Legislative Exchange Council. It is, of course, fine to conclude his perspective, but his affiliation needed to be noted to give listeners an idea of where he is coming from. So thank you for that, Barbara. And I guess some of the questions that are rising here, Ken, you may want to address them.
Yeah, Michael, there's quite a few of them there. I mean, you know, essentially one of the common themes of some of the statements was transit connectivity. And in many respects, the plan connects the transit network. That's one of its key objectives. People spoke about going around the bay and the need to connect things. BART to San Jose will connect in San Jose with Caltrain, which will be electrified. Those are projects that are moving forward now. The first of two phases is under construction for BART to San Jose, and the funding for the second phase is prioritized, and Caltrain electrification is advancing. In other respects, you know, I mentioned the capacity for the core of the BART system. That's something moving forward. MTC also has a project called the Transit Performance Initiative. This is really an initiative that really seeks to address how do we make this work for riders. You know, we are one of the, as a region, we have some of the highest transit, we have transit ridership that's quite high relative to the country. We have some of the highest percentages in terms of work commutes and so forth, of people using transit. And things are very much trending in the right direction. But we still have some challenges. One of those is the fact we do have multiple transit agencies here. And one of the things that we are doing moving forward is through our Transit Performance Initiative, we've created an incentive program to reward transit agencies that achieve ridership increases and productivity improvements, and funds are allocated based upon performance improvements. That's one thing. It's not part of the plan, but, you know, the Clipper card, which is something that MTC manages, is something that I think for many transit riders in the region who go from AC Transit to BART to Muni, for example, or VTA to Caltrain to BART, it's made their day easier. Riders don't so much care whether they're riding AC Transit or BART or Caltrain. They want a collective system that works. And I think in many respects, this plan and MTC are taking the steps to pull the systems together and make it more efficient for users.
I'm going to go to another emailer. And Stephanie Reyes, how would you respond to a listener named Carl who says, your small-town ambience comes at the cost of higher traffic density and other problems to others. Is that fair?
Is that fair? Well, I think I'll answer that in a couple of ways. You know, when we think about what is the big traffic issue in the Bay Area, most folks say, I am stuck on the freeway for hours and hours on end. That is the big traffic nightmare here in the region. And the beauty of Plan Bay Area is by planning for more homes near job centers and providing people with the option to live near transit and take the train to work, that will help get more people have the option to get off the freeway and reduce our regional traffic problem.
We'll bring more callers in to the picture here, and we go to Palo Alto. Arthur, join us. Hi.
Thank you. I'm actually a planning and transportation commissioner for the city of Palo Alto, and we've already met our greenhouse gas target of 20% reduction from 2005, and we have an inclusionary zoning ordinance that requires below-market-rate housing be built when you built market-rate housing. But the idea that we have a choice to grow is false. There's something that goes along with this called the regional housing needs allocation that basically forces us to grow, forces us to allocate and zone for housing, which can then be built by right, essentially. The plan includes Palo Alto and other communities that are suburban to grow by at least a third over the next so many years. This basically forces us to grow and doesn't even take into account our school capacity or our school needs. In fact, the CEQA analysis does not even allow school needs to be taken into account.
All right. I thank you for that call, Arthur. It brings us pretty much to the end of the hour here, although I'd like someone to address listeners' concern that I'll just read this last comment. They've done an extremely poor job of letting the public know about this. By not letting us know about this, they guarantee that we can't speak up and have our say. Simply posting notices of meetings online is not enough. They have violated basic tenets of democracy.
You know, I think one of the things, Michael, that's been interesting is, you know, particularly for a long-term MTC staffers, it used to be it was almost impossible to get people to turn out to a public hearing for the regional transportation plan. We have not had that problem with Plan Bay Area. We've had oversold meetings, 300 of them in total through this process over the last 3 years. So there's been a lot of public process. And, I think at the end of the day, because local land use authority is retained and local jurisdictions supported the plan, nominated these areas, there's a lot of public process that goes on at the local level as well.
Well, we'll have to let it stand there. Thanks, Ken Kirky from MTC, Metropolitan Transportation Commission. Thanks, Angela Hart from San Francisco Public Press, and Stephanie Reyes from the Greenbelt Alliance. Our thanks also to Tom Rubin, who it turns out is more than just a mass transit consultant. And also our thanks to Bob Silvestri, architect, who joined us, author of The Best Laid Plans. Thanks to you, our listeners. Another hour ahead, we're going to talk to a conservative constitutional scholar in the hour ahead. Peter Berkowitz will join us. Hope you will as well. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation, and by a generous gift from Jan Schrem and Maria Minetti Schrem, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.